Welcome to the Arizona Republic for Tuesday, March 31st. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Jack Palmer, with local, national, international, and USA Today headlines. The first article is titled, Arizona Health Nonprofit Sues Former CEO, written by Stephanie Innes. The former CEO of a major Arizona nonprofit health company used company meant for vulnerable patients to purchase luxury items for herself, including limousine services, hotel rooms, and football and concert tickets, a lawsuit filed by the company alleges. While the earning compensation of nearly $700,000 a year in her role as CEO of Mesa-based Copa Health, Shar Najafi Piper caused the organization to lose millions of dollars and at the same time used Copa's money for personal expenses, according to a lawsuit Copa Health filed in Maricopa County Superior Court. The civil lawsuit, filed March 23rd, names as defendants Najafi Piper, her husband Brian Piper, and Roya Health, LLC, a for-profit company that Copa Health officials say Najafi Piper created as a direct competitor to Copa while still the Copa CEO. Najafi Piper, her husband, and Roya Health have not yet filed responses to the lawsuit's allegations in the court. In a March 28th written statement she provided to the Arizona Republic, Najafi Piper said the lawsuit's allegations were not only false, but also manipulated to create a misleading narrative, and that all of her expenses related to Copa Health were meticulously approved, adhering strictly to every policy and procedure set forth. Najafi Piper said she was considering legal action against Copa Health and that the truth would be revealed during the court process, her statement said. Under my leadership, Copa Health experienced significant growth, doubling in revenue size, and successfully diversifying by partnering with all major health plans, the statement said. The lawsuit says most of Copa Health's money comes from Medicaid, which is a government health insurance program primarily financed with taxpayer money. It mainly provides coverage to people with low incomes and disabilities. Arizona's Medicaid program is called the Arizona Health Care Cost Containment System, or AHCCCS, pronounced ACCESS. Mesa-based Copa Health is a result of several mergers, most recently Mark Community Resources Incorporated and Partners in Recovery, LLC. The organization took in nearly $70 million in revenue for the fiscal year ending September 30, 2024, IRS records show. In 2024, it was named by the Phoenix Business Journal as one of the top three largest nonprofit companies in the Valley. The nonprofit provides care and services for people with serious mental illness in the state, as well as services for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, among other programs. On its website, Copa Health traces its origins to Mark Community Resources, which dates to 1957. By late 2020, Mark Community Resources and Partners in Recovery were operating as affiliates of Copa, the lawsuit says. Copa Health's article of incorporation was filed January 24, 2020, according to Arizona Corporation Commission's records. Copa Health was recently in the news for being the operator of a new 50-bed facility called Pathways of Hope that provides long-needed housing for people with serious mental illness in the Phoenix area. The lawsuit says COPPA paid Najafi Piper more than $2.5 million between 2022 and 2025, as well as nearly $20,000 per year for a car allowance. During the last year, the organization suffered multiple rounds of reductions in force, resulting in cuts to some of its programs serving the most vulnerable populations. It does not detail the reason for those cuts. Court documents say COPPA's board of directors voted unanimously on January 22nd to terminate Najafi Piper, who had led the organization since 2019. Najafi Piper orchestrated a years-long scheme to systematically plunder COPPA's resources to fund Roya Health and her lavish lifestyle, the lawsuit says. At times, Najafi Piper disparaged COPPA to its most critical business partners, the lawsuit says, while simultaneously promoting Roya Health as a superior alternative. A hearing in the civil case was scheduled for April 7th in front of Maricopa County Superior Judge Melissa Julian, according to court documents. COPPA Health attorneys have asked for a preliminary injunction to, among other requests, prevent Najafi Piper, her husband, and Roya Health from disparaging COPPA, including its employees and services, and from making any claims about current or prior affiliations between Roya Health and COPPA Health. The lawsuit contends Najafi Piper used COPPA's resources, including its employees and trade secrets, to advance Roya Health, which formed in 2022 in Florida, according to Arizona Corporation Commission records. Roya Health offers integrated primary and behavioral health care and lists two locations in Phoenix, one in Mesa, and upcoming locations in Glendale and in New Mexico. According to Najafi Piper, the inception of Roya Health was with the full approval of the COPPA's board chair, and every activity undertaken by Roya Health received appropriate approvals and was designed never to conflict with the operations of COPPA Health. Roya Health has a child and family model with a particular emphasis on special populations, Najafi Piper's statement says, and it does not engage in SMI, serious mental illness business, or major housing programs, and therefore does not compete with COPPA Health. Instead, Roya Health has complemented COPPA's mission by providing referrals, contributing to the broader community's well-being. The Roya Health website lists Najafi Piper as a co-founder and says the chief medical officer is Dr. Sarah Salek, who is the former chief medical officer for Access. Salek, who is not named in the lawsuit, could not be reached for comment. While devoting her efforts to Roya Health, the lawsuit says, Najafi Piper used COPPA's money for herself. Some of the expenses, the lawsuit says, Najafi Piper charged to COPPA are $3,074,000 for Arizona Cardinals football tickets and related expenses, $250,000 on dues, dinners, travels, and events with the Young Presidents Organization, which is a global community of chief executives, $200,000 on airfare and hotels for her and her family, including stays at resorts in France, Canada, Mexico, and Hawaii, $20,000 for luxury car and limousine service, $100,000 for a private security detail, $1,033 on new glasses, and $645 on designer shoes. Tickets to Justin Timberlake, Post Malone, Chris Stapleton, The Weeknd, and Lady Gaga concerts. In 2022, at Najafi Piper's urging, COPPA expanded into Utah, according to the lawsuit, and she would visit Utah for weeks at a time. Rather than staying in nearby Salt Lake City, Najafi Piper stayed an hour away in Park City and would only visit the COPPA office once or twice per trip. Under Najafi Piper's leadership, COPPA lost millions of dollars on its Utah expansion venture that Najafi Piper had championed but then failed to properly oversee or manage, the lawsuit says. Attorneys for COPPA Health did not respond immediately to a request for comment. The Arizona Attorney General's office on March 30th declined to comment. "We can't comment or deny any potential investigations," office spokesperson Richie Taylor wrote in an email. The next article is titled, "Author Calls for Recognition of Cesar Chavez Victims," written by Daniel Gonzalez. A former Arizona State University professor is the author of a book that sparked a New York Times investigation that revealed explosive allegations that Cesar Chavez molested and raped young girls and women, including the former civil rights icon's close associate in the farm worker movement, Dolores Huerta. Now, as communities in Arizona and around the nation grapple with the allegations and race to rename celebrations, parks, streets, schools, and take down statues and murals that honor Chavez, historian Matthew Garcia is sharing his thoughts on how communities should proceed. Many communities hold events honoring Chavez on or around March 31st, Chavez's birthday. Chavez has deep ties to Arizona. Chavez, the co-founder of the California-based United Farm Workers Union, was born outside Yuma and died in San Luis. He undertook many of his grueling fasts at a Catholic hall in Phoenix. There are many parks, streets, buildings, plazas, schools, murals, and statues that honor Chavez in communities across Arizona. "I'm really pleased that the response has been so forceful and that people are saying it's time to take down Cesar's statues and murals and all those things," Garcia said. "People should also be remembering the victims," he added. "There's also the question of restitution and what the union owes them. And there's the question of who helped Cesar potentially facilitate any abuse, and if so, how they should be held accountable," Garcia said. "Many of those people are still alive," he said. Garcia is author of the award-winning book From the Jaws of Victory, The Triumph and Tragedy of Cesar Chavez and the Farm Worker Movement. The book was published in 2012 when Garcia was a history professor at ASU. The book, which takes an unflinching look at Cesar Chavez's leadership of the UFW, contains a passage that talks about an extramarital affair Chavez had. The passage later prompted whistleblowers from the farmworker movement to contact Garcia about sexual misconduct by Chavez. Garcia said he put the whistleblowers in contact with reporters at the New York Times, who spent 5 years investigating the allegations, which culminated in a March 18th article that included interviews with two women, Anna Mugurier and Deborah Rojas, who say Chavez abused them for years when they were girls in the 1970s. Abuse allegations by the two women, who were the daughters of longtime organizers who had marched in rallies with Chavez, appeared to be part of a larger pattern of sexual misconduct by Chavez, much of which has never been publicly revealed, the Times investigation said. The Times investigation also included a stunning abuse allegation from Huerta, a prominent Latina activist, UFW co-founder, and close Chavez ally. In an allegation disclosed publicly for the first time, Huerta said that Chavez had raped her in a secluded grape field in 1966 in Delano, California, and she felt pressured to have sex with him during an earlier encounter during a work trip in 1960. The Times investigation also found that Chavez had fathered at least 4 children with 3 women besides his wife, including 2 who were the result of his sexual encounters with Huerta. Garcia is now a professor of Latin American, Latino, and Caribbean studies and history at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. The abuse allegations against Chavez, who died in 1993, are coming out at a time when a cultural shift is dismantling the pathological patriarchy that has long dominated society, Garcia said, beginning with the exposure of former Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein's decades of sexual misconduct, which triggered the Me Too movement, the ongoing revelations into the Jeffrey Epstein sex trafficking scandal, and now the sexual abuse allegations against Chavez. It's a challenge, I think, to the Mexican-American community, of which I'm a member, to start to listen to women and to think about men's behavior, Garcia said. We can't live like this anymore. Women can't be discounted, can't be molested, can't be touched, can't be spoken of with derogatory terms that men think are okay, like mija or hun. That stuff has got to go. At the same time, a reckoning now taking place within the Mexican-American community and the larger Latino community of which it is a part extends to all of society, Garcia said. I think it's very important for us to consider this history not as a kind of cultural phenomenon of the Mexican-American community, but it is a general questioning of men's powers and their abuse of power in society writ large, Garcia said. And I'm not worried if President Trump makes something out of it, or the right wing makes something of it, or people think it's a Mexican-American problem. It's not. It's an American problem. With the exposure of the sex abuse allegations against Chavez, who is perhaps the most famous Latino in the United States, the Mexican-American community has an opportunity to demonstrate how to move forward, Garcia said. I hope that people can start learning from the women and learning from their mistakes and turning a corner, Garcia said. Still, Garcia has reservations about a movement gaining momentum that seeks to rename celebrations and places that honored Chavez with Huerta's name. His book showed that Huerta also had a history of abusing people in the farm workers' movement and the United Farm Workers Union in the 1970s, though not sexually, Garcia said. With regards to replacing Cesar with Dolores, I have problems with that, because my history that I've written in From the Jaws of Victory shows that Dolores was abusive to members within the movement in the 1970s, not sexually, but she participated in the purging of innocent victims, members of the union, and volunteers who had been wrongly accused of being communist, being gay, not being committed like she was, and not sacrificing what she sacrificed to the union. So in my book, I show that in essence, sometimes the abused becomes the abuser, Garcia said. The next article is titled, President Warns Iran It Risks More Attacks, written by Bart Jansen, Christopher Kahn, Andrea Requiri, and Tao Nguyen. President Donald Trump on March 30th said the United States was engaged in serious discussions with Iranian officials on a deal to end the war, but threatened to launch strikes on the country's power, oil, and water facilities if negotiations fail. Great progress has been made, Trump said on Truth Social. However, he continued, if a deal is not reached shortly and the Strait of Hormuz remains effectively closed, the United States will conclude our lovely stay in Iran by blowing up and completely obliterating all of their electric generating plants, oil wells, and Karg Island, and possibly all desalinization plants, which we have purposefully not yet touched. Experts say intentionally targeting civilian infrastructure, such as water desalinization plants, may constitute a violation of international humanitarian law. More than a month into the war, Iran has maintained its grip on the critical trade route, raising energy prices globally. The president told reporters March 29th that Iran had responded favorably to 15 points the United States proposed to end the war. Trump hasn't detailed the demands. As an indication Tehran was moving toward a peace agreement, Trump cited Iran's decision to allow 10 oil tankers through the Strait of Hormuz. They're agreeing with us on the plan, Trump told reporters aboard Air Force One. We're having very good meetings, both directly and indirectly, and I think we're getting a lot of very important points. Washington and Tehran have continued to send conflicting messages about talks to end the war. Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Ismail Baghaei said that the U.S. proposals were unrealistic, illogical, and excessive. Our position is clear. We are under military aggression. Therefore, all our efforts and strength are focused on defending ourselves, he said at a press conference. Trump also said there has been regime change in Iran. The one regime was decimated, destroyed, Trump claimed on board Air Force One. The next regime is mostly dead, and the third regime, we're dealing with different people than anybody's dealt with before. It's a whole different group of people. So I would consider that regime change, and frankly, they've been very reasonable. Secretary of State Marco Rubio appeared to contradict Trump on both points. Rubio told Good Morning America, it would be good news for the Iranians and America if there are new people in charge who have a more reasonable vision of the future. But we also have to be prepared for the possibility, maybe even the probability, that that's not the case, Rubio said. He said there are people in Iran who are saying the right things in private, but the United States has to see if they end up being the ones with the power to deliver. We're going to test it. We're hopeful that that's the case, he said. Rubio declined again during the interview to say who the administration was speaking with in the negotiations. Even so, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said on Fox and Friends that an increasing number of ships have traveled through the strait, with 20 more expected March 30th. Iran stepped up its strikes on Israel and its neighbors across the Middle East over the weekend, and thousands of additional U.S. troops arrived in the region. Thousands have been killed across Iran. The health ministry in Lebanon, where humanitarian groups have reported Israeli forces destroying whole residential areas, said more than 1,200 people have been killed there. Debris from an intercepted missile struck Israel's largest refinery on March 30th, according to the country's fire and rescue service. Smoke could be seen billowing from the refinery in Haifa. No casualties were reported, and Israel's fire and rescue service said production facilities were not impacted. Pushback to the hostilities came from a NATO ally. Spain's defense minister on March 30th announced his country had closed its airspace to U.S. aircraft involved in attacks on Iran, a move likely to escalate tensions between Madrid and Washington. Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez has been one of the most vocal opponents of the U.S. and Israeli attacks on Iran, describing them as reckless and illegal. The price of oil jumped after Trump's Truth Social threat. Brent crude futures were above $114 a barrel, up about 2%, although gas prices, which take a few days to catch up, were lower. GasBuddy's nationwide tracker showed an average cost of $3.95 per gallon, down nearly 3 cents from the week before. Many investors remain concerned. Don Rissmiller, chief economist for Stratagas, summarized his feelings in a note the morning of March 30th. The hit to real income due to inflation spiking near term looks substantial, he wrote. Longer term interest rates are rising. That combination of higher rates and oil should slow economic growth as we move through 2026. If there is not significant progress toward normalization in the Strait of Hormuz over the next week, we will raise our U.S. recession odds in 2026 from 25% to 35%. The Federal Reserve is monitoring rising inflation expectations, Fed Chair Jerome Powell said. He told a class of Harvard University students that he believes U.S. monetary policy is in a good place, but that Americans' inflation expectations will help inform how the central bank responds to oil price spikes resulting from the Iran war. After supply shocks drove inflation to 40-year highs during the pandemic, and with tariffs now pushing prices higher, Powell said it's understandable that businesses and households would expect inflation to rise following the start of the conflict. He added, however, that those expectations remain stable over the longer term. By the time the effects of a tightening in monetary policy takes effect, the oil price shock is probably long gone. Forecasters currently predict the Fed will hold its benchmark rate steady at a range of 3.5% to 3.75% at its next meeting at the end of April. You're listening to Hour One of today's Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Jack Palmer, and we'll continue with an article titled, Former Buckeye Officer Faces Review Over Incident with Son, written by Elena Santa Cruz. A former school resource officer's law enforcement certification is in jeopardy after he was accused of assaulting his son in 2024. The Arizona Peace Officer Standards and Training Board a law enforcement regulatory agency, agreed to take action against David Ellison's eligibility to operate as a police officer in Arizona. Ellison was stationed at Verado High School for more than a decade, and, according to police spokesperson Carissa Planalp, served with Buckeye Police for 15 years. Most cases reviewed by the board typically result in a 6 to 12 month suspension or revocation of an officer's certification. Officers can also choose to voluntarily surrender their certification, according to AZ Post Executive Director Chuck Miller. Revocations are relatively rare. Miller noted that the board approved only 4 in 2025. Ellison, an accomplished officer, is no longer with Buckeye Police. He resigned in May 2025 before the department could issue a punishment following an internal investigation. He declined to comment for this article. On October 28, 2024, police responded to Ellison's Goodyear home after his 15-year-old called 911, reporting that his father was drunk and had assaulted him, according to AZ Post compliance specialist Alfred Grijalva at the board's March 18th meeting. The teen told police that an argument began when Ellison returned home. At one point, he was pushed outside and not allowed back in. The teen then punched a dent in his father's work truck following comments from Ellison that Grijalva did not detail. Ellison threatened to kill him if he touched his truck again, Grijalva told the board. The teen said his dad taunted him, then headbutted him, according to Grijalva. The teen said he pushed his dad away, but that Ellison choked and punched him, according to Grijalva. The teen's nose then started bleeding. Ellison tried choking him again by putting his arm around his neck and lifting him, according to Grijalva. The teen told police he had yelled multiple times about how he could not breathe, but his father threw him to the ground, Grijalva said. The teen managed to call 911. The responding officers reported that the injuries they observed were consistent with the teen's story, and Ellison had the signs and symptoms of alcohol intoxication, Grijalva said. Ellison told police he had consumed alcohol, but could not explain why his son's face was bloody, according to Grijalva. Ellison mentioned that rocks were thrown at his truck and house. Ellison was arrested and charged with disorderly conduct and assault, both with domestic violence elements, according to the Goodyear Municipal Court. At the time, the Buckeye Police Department said in a statement that police officers, especially those in charge of the safety and well-being of students, must be held to the highest standards. The statement said the allegations were troubling and did not align with our core values of integrity, safety, respect, and compassion. Ellison admitted guilt in Goodyear Municipal Court and pleaded to non-domestic violence disorderly conduct, Grijalva said. But according to the court, the charge was dismissed. In January 2025, Ellison entered an agreement that dismissed the assault charge and deferred prosecution on the other charge. The agreement did not say anything about Ellison's being unable to see his son, according to the court, and the domestic violence element was removed from both charges at the prosecutor's request. To get the disorderly conduct charge dismissed, he had to pay the court a $100 fine, complete an anger management course, and undergo alcohol and drug treatment, according to the court. He fulfilled those requirements, and the charge was dismissed in February 2025, according to the court. In an informal affairs investigation conducted by Buckeye Police, Allison's description of the night differed slightly from his son's, according to details provided by Grijalva. Allison said he got into a verbal argument with his son over household rules when he arrived home. He admitted to investigators that he had been drinking alcohol before he got home, Grijalva said. Allison said he walked away to de-escalate the situation, but they continued to argue and his son punched his work truck. The confrontation turned physical in the front yard and included mutual shoving, yelling, and Ellison told investigators he was hit at least once in the face, Grijalva said. The two fell into the gravel, and Ellison, according to Grijalva, said he restrained his son by wrapping his arms around the teen's torso and underarms. The former Buckeye cop denied hitting his son and maintained that he believed his use of force was reasonable, according to Grijalva. Ellison also denied choking his son to investigators and said he never heard the 15-year-old complain about breathing, Grijalva said. He admitted forcibly pushing and throwing his son, according to Grijalva. The Buckeye Police Department found Ellison had violated 8 policies, which Grijalva did not detail. The compliance specialist told the board that the police department indicated it would recommend that Ellison be terminated. It may be some time before action is taken on Ellison's officer certification. Miller said each case was significantly different based on the allegations, its complexity, and the internal investigation provided by AZ Post. Buckeye Police spokesperson Sergeant Zach Astrup said the department had no additional comments to share about Ellison. Astrup referred to the Buckeye Police's 2024 statement. If you've missed any of these articles, you can always listen on demand by going to our website, sunsounds.org, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, and then On Demand. The next article is titled, Artemis II Mission Set to Launch, written by Eric Legata. 3 Americans and 1 Canadian will set their sights on heading toward the moon for the first time in more than half a century. Yes, robotic U.S. landers have begun to touch down on the moon, but ever since the Apollo era came to an end in 1972, humans have yet to venture back anywhere near Earth's celestial neighbor. Now that's due to change with the launch of a NASA mission known as Artemis II. The second, under the U.S. Space Agency's multi-billion-dollar Artemis program, the mission is also the first in the renewed lunar campaign with a crew. While those crew members won't be making a lunar landing, their 10-day journey around the moon and back will pave the way for NASA to put boots back on the surface in the years ahead. The mission will also make history, with the astronauts traveling farther from Earth than any human has ever been in space. While traveling up to 6,000 miles above the lunar surface, the astronauts will see parts of the far side of the moon that not even the Apollo astronauts witnessed. NASA is working toward an April 1st launch of the Artemis II mission, with a 2-hour launch window opening at 6:24 p.m. Eastern Time. If bad weather or any other issues arise before liftoff, NASA has also announced other launch opportunities available April 2nd through 6th, and again April 30th. The long-awaited mission was originally slated for February, before hydrogen fuel leaks and, more recently, helium flow issues on NASA's towering 322-foot Space Launch System rocket prompt a series of delays. All of NASA's Artemis missions will get off the ground from the Kennedy Space Center in Cape Canaveral, located along Florida's Atlantic coast. The rocket that will provide the initial burst of thrust at liftoff to send the astronauts on their way is known as the Space Launch System, built by Boeing and Northrop Grumman. Towering at 322 feet tall, the SLS rocket isn't quite as tall as the retired 363-foot Saturn V used during the Apollo era, but it's much more powerful. In fact, the 8.8 million pounds of thrust it generates at takeoff is more than 15% more power than Saturn V's capability, making it the most powerful spacecraft NASA has ever launched. The SLS rocket is composed of a 212-foot core stage propelled by four engines powered by a mix of liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen, as well as two 177-foot-tall solid rocket boosters mounted to the sides, providing the bulk of the thrust, a measure of the amount of force used to push the vehicle off the ground. The astronauts themselves will be aboard an Orion crew capsule built by Lockheed Martin, which will hitch a ride to orbit atop the SLS rocket. Established during President Donald Trump's first term, NASA's Artemis lunar program is the space agency's ambitious campaign to return American astronauts to the surface of the moon for the first time since the Apollo era came to an end in 1972. NASA's ultimate objective in the years ahead is to use both uncrewed and human lunar landings to set up a permanent moon base on the South Pole. A moon landing is now due to take place as early as 2028 during a mission known as Artemis IV. Prior to that mission, Artemis III astronauts aboard the Orion capsule are due to meet and dock in 2027 in Earth orbit, with at least one of the commercial lunar landers being developed by Elon Musk's SpaceX and Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin. NASA will also use the mission to test spacesuits known as extravehicular activity suits being developed by Axiom Space for astronauts on the lunar surface. After the Artemis V mission, NASA Administrator Jared Isaacman has said the agency wants to target a human lunar landing up to twice a year, if not more often. The moon's largely unexplored South Pole is where water ice is thought to be abundant that could be extracted and used for drinking, breathing, and as a source of hydrogen and oxygen for rocket fuel. From there, the first astronauts could be embarking on voyages to Mars. The last U.S. astronaut to land on the moon was on December 19, 1972, during NASA's Apollo 17 mission. All told, NASA astronauts have been to the moon on six separate Apollo missions, beginning with Apollo 11 in 1969. But Artemis II most closely resembles a mission known as Apollo 8, which on December 21, 1968, sent three NASA astronauts on a 6-day trip orbiting the moon. The four crew members of Artemis II arrived in Florida on March 27th after entering standard pre-flight quarantine to avoid illness. NASA astronaut Reid Weissman is a Baltimore native and the mission's commander who last flew in space in 2014 on a Russian Soyuz rocket to the International Space Station. NASA astronaut Victor Glover is a pilot from Pomona, California, who flew to space in 2020 on a SpaceX mission to the space station. NASA astronaut Christina Koch is a mission specialist from Grand Rapids, Michigan, who holds several space agency records and who flew in 2019 on a Soyuz ISS mission. Canadian Space Agency astronaut Jeremy Hansen is another mission specialist who will fly to space for the first time. Glover is due to become the first black astronaut to travel near the moon, while Koch will become the first woman to do so, Reuters reported. Additionally, Hansen is set to become the first Canadian to fly close to the moon. The planned trajectory for the 4-day return journey will use Earth's gravity to naturally pull Orion back home after flying by the moon, negating the need for propulsion or much fuel. Once Orion blazes through the Earth's atmosphere, a protective shield will be cast off to make way for parachutes to deploy and slow it down. The capsule will then make a water landing in the Pacific Ocean near California, after which 5 orange airbags will inflate around the top of the spacecraft and flip the capsule into an upright position to allow the crew to exit. The next article is titled, "Charges Dropped in Louisville Death," written by Monroe Trombley and Tom Nguyen. A congressman has urged the Trump administration to stop interfering with the pursuit of justice after a federal judge dismissed all remaining charges against 2 former Louisville police officers accused of providing false information on a no-knock search warrant that led to the fatal 2020 shooting of Breonna Taylor. U.S. District Judge Charles Simpson signed an order March 27th dismissing the charges against Joshua Janes and Kyle Meany with prejudice, meaning federal prosecutors cannot bring the same charges against them again using the same evidence. Both Janes and Meany were involved in drafting the search warrant used in the botched raid that killed Taylor, 26 years old, in March 2020. The dismissal came a week after federal prosecutors asked Simpson to dismiss the charges in the interests of justice. It was an expected but notable development in the federal case against the former Louisville police officers, which began in 2022. Under President Donald Trump, the U.S. Department of Justice has tried to pause or drop many civil rights cases started under the previous administration. Though Meany and Janes were not present during the shooting, both were accused by federal prosecutors of neglecting necessary steps to obtain the warrant for Taylor's apartment. Meany was accused of knowingly providing false, misleading, and outdated information, while Janes was accused of supplying false information to secure the warrant. U.S. Representative Morgan McGarvey, a Democrat who represents Louisville, sent a letter on March 27th to Attorney General Pam Bondi in the wake of the dismissal, asking the Department of Justice to stop interfering with and undermining Louisville's efforts to deliver justice for Miss Taylor's family and atone for her death as a community. The DOJ's decision to walk away from this case and their argument that it is somehow in the interest of justice is insulting, given the Trump administration's persistent undermining of police and justice reform efforts here in Louisville, and its utter abandonment of any kind of civil rights enforcement nationwide, McGarvey wrote to Bondi. In a statement, the Louisville branch of the NAACP described the dismissal as another troubling sign that the current leadership of the Department of Justice does not value accountability when black lives are taken. Justice delayed has now become justice denied, the civil rights organization said in its statement. This decision sends a dangerous message that those who abuse their authority and manipulate the system will not be held accountable. The Louisville Metro Police Department fired Janes in 2021 for police violations and dismissed Meany in August 2022, following his federal indictment. As it stood, the case against Janes and Meany had already been weakened. Last year, Judge Simpson, an 80-year-old appointee of President Ronald Reagan, dismissed the most serious charges after ruling that the government could not prove Meany and Janes' actions had directly caused Taylor's death. Thomas Clay, Janes' lawyer, said the DOJ has finally done what it should have done years ago, and that he was happy for Janes and his family. Michael Denbow, who represents Meany, said that his client is overjoyed and incredibly relieved now that the case has been dismissed. Taylor, an emergency room technician, was inside her apartment when she was fatally shot by plainclothes officers at around 12:40 a.m. March 13, 2020, during a narcotics investigation. Officers, who said they knocked and announced themselves several times before forcibly entering, had been trying to serve a no-knock search warrant. Neither Taylor nor Kenneth Walker, her boyfriend at the time, was the target of the investigation, and no drugs were found in the home. Walker and several also said they did not hear the officers identify themselves as law enforcement. As police entered the apartment, Walker shot an officer in the leg. He later said he believed the officers were intruders. Taylor's death sparked months of protest in Louisville and other cities around the country. In December 2024, the Louisville Metro Police Department and the city's government reached an agreement on civil rights reforms with the Department of Justice. But the plan was delayed by a lack of approval from a federal judge, and federal prosecutors announced in May 2025 that they would abandon negotiations. Two other Louisville police officers, Brett Henkison and Kelly Goodlett, were also charged by federal prosecutors in 2022 in connection with the no-knock raid. Henkison is currently free on bond while he appeals a conviction for violating Taylor's civil rights, which resulted in a 33-month sentence. During the raid, he fired 10 shots through a covered sliding glass door and window, with some rounds entering a neighboring apartment. The 33-month sentence was imposed by U.S. District Judge Rebecca Grady Jennings, despite the Department of Justice's request of just one day. Henkison promptly sought his release, but Jennings denied the request. He was then released in December 2025 after about 2 months of incarceration when a Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals panel ruled 2-1 that the former officer was not a flight risk or a danger to the community and that he had raised compelling concerns regarding his safety in federal custody. In that case, the Department of Justice also intervened on Hankison's behalf and sought his release. Goodlett, the fourth Louisville police officer, pleaded guilty in 2022 to helping falsify an affidavit for the warrant for Taylor's apartment. She has not yet been sentenced. The next article is entitled, Birth Tourism Enters Immigration Debate, written by Bart Jansen. Companies with names like USA Happy Baby and Star Baby Care offered to shepherd pregnant women from China or any other country into the United States to give birth to children recognized as U.S. citizens before returning home. Women were coached to wear baggy clothing to hide their pregnancies and misled customs officials about how long they would stay, according to federal criminal indictments against the enterprises. Star Baby Care said on its website that it provided services to 8,000 pregnant women spanning 20 years. USA Happy Baby said it charged VIP customers up to $100,000. But the extent of birth tourism and its threat to national security is hotly contested. Estimates range from a marginal 2,000 babies a year to disputed allegations of 1.5 million over a 15-year span. The higher figure has made its way into congressional testimony and into arguments that the Supreme Court will hear April 1st. The justices will decide whether President Donald Trump can limit birthright citizenship by executive order, despite the court's past interpretation of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, ratified more than 150 years ago. The High Court has interpreted the amendment for more than 125 years as providing citizenship to nearly everyone born in the United States. Trump and his allies contend citizenship was never intended for people delivering children on vacation. But opponents of the move, including congressional Democrats and 140 university professors, contend that the problem is exaggerated and that laws are already in place to combat birth tourism. And that's all the time we have for this hour of the Arizona Republic. I'm your broadcast volunteer, Jack Palmer. Stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona.